This is audiobook of I Visited Another Planet in a Flying Saucer, by Antonio Rossi, 1957. Translated by David Walsh. An astonishing account of a journey to another planet, in a flying saucer. Evolution and progress of an advanced humanity that surpasses anything imaginable. Thanksgiving to the noble hearts who so readily understood the scope of these stories and selflessly contributed to their dissemination, I can only say, the contents of your hearts are all generosity. I don't know where, when or under what circumstances I will repay them. A. Rossi. Preface. We know the author perfectly well. A metal worker, a simple, hard-working, helpful man with a virtuous character, setting an example both at home and on the street, which is why Antonio Rossi's story is worthy of study, especially in the light of the gospel, which tells us that in my father's house there are many mansions. It would be a foolish presumption to imagine billions of twinkling stars, without life, without intelligent life adorning the universal framework just for our eyes. If the scientific part, as presented by the author, doesn't entirely satisfy our inner longings, then let's take advantage of the concepts of sound morality that the work contains, capable of elevating us to yet another evolutionary step. So let's move on, dear reader, to the description of what, that, if it happened to us, it would be difficult for others to believe. São Paulo, the 12th of April 1957. General Levino Cornelio Wisrall. Preamble. This trip was characterized by unprecedented circumstances, due to the picturesque and almost unbelievable way in which it was carried out. At the outset, I want to make it clear, I have no intention of imposing anything or mystifying anyone. If we accept, an illusory assumption, that the immensity of the universe is there in all its glory, just to delight our eyes, we stubbornly persist in our error. If we feel diminutive in the face of the cosmic grandeur, however, we refuse to accept its full reality and try to delude ourselves into believing that we are the only intelligent beings in the universe. So we, the enlightened, the privileged, still prefer to persevere in incongruity, continuing to reject what has always been logical and universal. I have learnt that the truth can and must be proclaimed to everyone, at any time and under any circumstances, hence the reason for this booklet. I have therefore endeavoured, within my simple language and modest knowledge, to narrate the events that happened to me, as well as to relate the magnificent things I witnessed on that marvellous and strange planet. In this way, I am sure that, indirectly, I will be able to share through Dr. Janzel, that great and fraternal friend of mine, the teaching of this booklet, whose text falls far short of the true merit and magnanimity of those evolved beings from the high world they inhabit. Let's try to follow them. A. Rossi. Note from the author. Transcription of an extract from Chapter 1. Little by little, my eyes began to receive a kind of clarity, a certain strange clarity, perceived by my brain now, registering in the form of words the thoughts that those strange visitors were addressing to me. Noting, however, that I could clearly feel the emission of their thoughts, which I conceived as if they were articulated sentences. Without emitting any sound, they possessed what we might call visual speech. They communicated, therefore, through the silent expressive gaze, transmitting visual speech or visual telepathy. A convention that has now been established, so, dear reader, in view of the lack of vocabulary and in order for ease of expression, it is agreed that, whenever you come across the use of verbs, such as, to say, to narrate, to speak, to utter, to express, tell, report, reveal, expose and other similar verbs indicating the action or effect of transmitting information on the part of the inhabitants of the unknown world, it is to be understood that nothing has been articulated or pronounced verbally by them, but that the words were always transmitted to me through their eyes, in the silent propagation of what I have called visual telepathy. AR, Chapter 1 The Unexpected Encounter. To soften the harsh hours of life and breathe a little fresh air, once or twice a month, in the company of some friends, I go to Paraibuna, a town in the north of the state, in the hope of fishing in the river that lends it its name. There is an abundant species of fish in that region, where there are beautiful and tasty specimens that reach around 12 kilos. Surrounded by green and beautiful mountains and colossal quarries, the Paraibuna runs through the town, which is 150 kilometers from the capital of São Paulo. From the top of the mountains, a dazzling panorama offers itself to our view. Down below, the stone-bedded river writhes, inviting us to throw our hooks into its waters and offering us physical rest and hours of undisturbed peace of mind in the friendly shade of its trees. On one occasion, in fact, on a regular Saturday, when we arrived at the riverbank, while my companions were setting up the tent, I grabbed some sandwiches, a machete, bait and lines and set off in search of a more suitable place to fish. I've yet to meet a fisherman who doesn't have technical preferences and a liking for a particular place. So I looked for such a spot away from my companions. I soon came across such an inviting spot, put my machete and sandwiches down beside me and sat down and cast into the bubbling rapids. Blessed hour when I settled into that spot. Checking my watch, its dial showed 20 minutes to 5 p.m. on a beautiful spring afternoon. The sun was setting in the west and its heat, now getting cooler, was reduced by some clouds that had accidentally covered it. Amused by the fishing, either picking up the line and checking the bait had been bitten by small fish, or trying to throw it into where the fish were, or trying to throw it in a deeper depth so that it would settle in a favorable direction, he remained quiet and attentive, waiting for the right moment to strike the hook. He was enjoying a peaceful moment when, shaking my head, I saw two strange creatures, different from our physical complexion, approaching at a slow pace. The distance between them and me was about 30 meters. For a moment, I didn't know what to do, I just felt great fear. When they reached about 10 meters, I leapt to my feet, and wanted to get away from them, but I couldn't. My feet were like lead. My feet were stuck to the ground. Stunned and sweating, I saw them coming towards me. They stopped 2 meters, one in front and one further back. They stared at me and their eyes were locked on mine as I stared at them in amazement. Static, unable to articulate any sound, in the condition of being incapacitated, I felt a dramatic and interminable minute elapse. They didn't say anything straight away, but with a broad smile, they continued to stare at me. They kept their eyes fixed on me, as if they were trying to read my thoughts. I then began to think. Gradually, I regained my composure and, with some difficulty, risked a very inexpressive greeting, mumbling, "Good afternoon." However, to my astonishment, I didn't get any response, but I could tell by the expression on their smiles that their faces had become more paternal, showing satisfaction. The first impression of dread was overcome. Of course, I could see that they were people of different physical complexion, because they were absolutely naked. They had no sexual organs, they were very tall, and they must have weighed around 120 kilos. They had only 2 fingers on each hand and each foot, and they were hairless. They kept smiling, and through their eyes, emanated an air of strangeness and kindness. So I took courage, I gave them a somewhat wan smile and asked, "Would you like anything?" In response, the one in front, after shaking his head in the negative, raised his arm, pointing to his own eyes. Not understanding his gesture, I stared at him, trying to interpret his mysterious attitude. After a while, my eyes began to receive a kind of clarity, a certain strange lucidity, perceived by my brain. A clarity to where my brain was registering in the form of words the thoughts that those strange visitors were addressing to me. They said nothing, yet I could clearly feel the emission of their thoughts, conceived by me as if they were articulated sentences. Without uttering a sound, they possessed what we might call visual speech. They communicated, therefore, through the silent gaze, transmitting visual speech or visual telepathy. Trying to be attentive and focusing intently, I began to understand what they were transmitting to me. "Here we are with the peace of God. We are inhabitants of another planet and don't be afraid because no harm will come to you. Our mission is beneficial in every way, both for you and for your fellow human beings. Understanding exactly what they were telling me, I sat attentively and they continued their monologue. Have confidence in us that we have come to invite you to visit our world. We're not demanding it, we're just inviting you. If you accept, we'll be there in a few hours. At this point, my brain, in our intimate connection, I was better able to follow the meaning of the words that comprised that mysterious form of language. Inexplicably, then, without me being able to put my finger on the reason, I found it easier to understand. And so, they continued to transmit their visual speech to me. We assure you that we will bring you back in the same health and disposition as you are now. You can tell your fellow human beings everything you have seen and learned. Think about it, this is a great opportunity for you. Very suspicious, I glanced sideways at my machete, thinking what an excellent weapon of defense it was, when, with real astonishment, one of them, taking about 3 steps, with decorum and a certain elegance, bent down and picked it up from the ground. Without realizing the result of this attitude, I saw him approach me, with a smile on his lips, and proffered the machete that I held in fear. I hung it back on my belt. Faced with this gesture of trust, I started to think more clearly, pondering, if they wanted to, they can take me by force, because they are much more powerful. Of course, they are peaceful or they don't know the value of a machete. That's what I said to myself, continuing to fix my eyes on them. Their eyes radiated sympathy and serenity, when my interlocutor, pointing the way between the rocks, told me, "Let's go." From then on, our first dialogue took place. Because I was in an unusual state of mind and on the assumption they were not aggressive, but peaceful, I asked them, keeping my eyes fixed on theirs, "How can we get to your world? Have you ever heard of flying saucers?" "Yes," I said. "We're the crew of one of these discs. Would you like to go? Our craft is waiting for us nearby." "What is this craft?" I asked curiously. "Our craft is what you call a flying saucer or flying disc." I thought about it and quickly realized, they must be much more intelligent than us and they're not forcing me to go with them, they're just inviting me. "Come with us if you want to," one of them added. That done, they started walking and I waited for them to get some distance away. When they had traveled some distance, I decided to follow them to see where they were going. I walked after them. However, fearful as I was, I traveled a short distance between the rocks, taking care to keep up with them. Then, after rounding a large boulder, I received the biggest surprise of my life. I came across, in a low spot, an enormous and unknown device. I was amazed and powerless to take any action. I stopped in my tracks. Astonished, I looked at that colossus that instilled awe and made me feel small in the face of the unknowable. Then, I saw that it was something from another world. Of course, it must have come from a much more materially advanced people. For a few minutes I waited, as an insignificant spectator, for some unforeseen event. It was a strange device, unlike anything I had ever seen in my 35 years of existence. It was a completely polished object. It was pale gray in color, had the shape of a rounded sentry box and measured about 30 meters in diameter. Its height, up to the maximum of its dome, must have been about 9 meters. It was hovering in the air, free from any contact with the ground, at a height of more or less half a meter. Its impeccable lines, with aerodynamic contours, were reminiscent of the most daring designs of our aviation technicians. I could never have imagined such an aesthetic machine, such and harmony, style and grandeur. Right there, however, I found myself in front of a true, genuine and authentic flying saucer. Chapter 2, The Journey in the Flying Saucer. After a few moments of ecstatic contemplation of that gigantic device, I decided to take a few more steps and arrive at the so-called flying saucer. Slowly, as I approached, A door opened and inside I noticed a being just like the ones I had been following. Then those two beings, leaning against a recess of the door, successively climbed up the entryway after gazing at me, renewing the invitation to accompany them. I stood for a few moments at the door of that great machine unknown to me. I had never even heard of them, except in newspaper comments published by the sensationalist press. In fact, I confess that I was fearful, but filled with intense curiosity, eager to know what it was like on the inside. In the meantime, they insisted that I get on the craft and encouraged me to imitate the movements made by them. I wondered about the possibilities of survival, what my fate would be if I got in the flying saucer. However, I concluded, I'm sure nothing will happen to me, because they would have behaved differently. As I continued to receive such a kind invitation, by the serene gaze of those beings, I thought of God to whom I had entrusted my destiny and my life. Then I had no more doubts. I decided to go. I climbed up, trying to make the same movements as those who had preceded me, taking advantage of the doorway. However, as soon as I took two steps inside, I stopped to see if it was still open. Then the third crew member who was waiting for us inside the flying saucer turned to me and said the following, "No harm will come to you, but I want to know if you are really willing to go. Do you really want to go, or are you just overawed by what you're seeing?" Faced with such a cordial question, I replied, "I'm going of my own free will." After having made such a positive resolution, I had the feeling, at that moment, I realized that my firm decision was helping to calm my mind and give me a greater dose of confidence, because I felt I had regained control of myself. Now, much calmer, with full lucidity, I recognized that I was facing beings who were more intelligent, albeit strange, who had slow but harmonious movements, with unusual but calm features that, in everything, denoted firmness of attitude, in control of their surroundings. After my reply, I saw him heading towards a container on a wall. It protruding about 15 centimeters from the inner wall of the disc itself. It was about 30 centimeters long. It had the appearance and shape of an egg, cut in half and entirely transparent, containing a light brown liquid. It must have been a deposit of some kind of substance for his own use, but I could never have guessed what it was for. With a slow gesture, the being reached into the container and took from a small shelf beside it, an object that I saw to be a small drinking glass, and filled it with the liquid it contained. To do so, it pressed a button on the side of the tank, a button made like the starter button on our cars, causing the liquid, which was as thick as honey, to gush out of a hole at the bottom. Then, showing it to me, he poured it into his mouth and swallowed as if he were savoring something. Then he took another glass and repeated the operation, filling it halfway. With the glass in his hand, he approached me and said the following, "To be able to travel, it is essential to drink this preparation." As he said this, he handed me the glass, with a capacity of perhaps a quarter of hours. I held it. My brain was buzzing. Is it poison? Is it some kind of narcotic so that I can endure a journey? What good will this do? And I answered myself, it can't be poison. They wouldn't try to poison me so obviously. After all, I thought, once I'm dead, I'll be of little use to them, and if it's an anesthetic, I'll inevitably come to my senses. I was struggling with my thoughts when again, in a very calm manner, that person said, "It's extremely important to drink it." Mindful of this recommendation, I brought the glass to my mouth and lightly touched the liquid on the tip of my tongue. At that moment, my thoughts flew to God. The instinct for self-preservation and love of life came over me like never before. Truly, I was in a precarious condition of between life and death, in front of those creatures watching me attentively. At that anguished moment, I suddenly brought the glass to my mouth and drank its contents. It was indeed a viscous liquid with a strange flavor, a kind of liquid vitamin that we usually take during fasting to supply calcium. I gave him the vessel back. He smiled gently and made me understand, asking me, "Can we go now?" "Yes, was my reply. As soon as I had finished mumbling this affirmative, I realized the door closed automatically. They pointed out a stool for me to sit on. In turn, I walked indecisively, dazzled by everything I was seeing and witnessing, to the designated place. Inside an environment I had never dreamed of, in a state of foolishness, acting like a child inside a haunted house, I looked at everything with spectacular admiration and respect. Let's face it, my attitude couldn't have been any different, and neither could the reflections of my feelings. I scrutinized my surroundings. With a slow movement of my head, I looked at everything. I can't say how long I spent scrutinizing that room. There was no mistaking the fact that the room we were in was about 8 meters in diameter, completely round, with smooth walls and a curved, dome-shaped ceiling, and was very well lit. It's essential to emphasize that everything that conformed to the configuration of the circle. There wasn't a single object that wasn't spherical or rounded. The principle was unique and general, everything had a curved shape. In the center of the room, there was a circular table with a radius of 1 meter, surrounded by a dozen stools fixed to the floor. These stools, very similar to our stools, were about 60 centimeters high, had a single foot, and were spread out symmetrically around the room, except on the side of a mysterious panel. Despite the light being bright, I couldn't distinguish the origin of it. The light was equally intense and diffuse at all angles. Not a single shadow was cast, giving the impression that the light was coming from the ceiling, the walls, or the floor of the flying saucer itself. With our current knowledge, we will never be able to obtain such a perfect, uniform, and even diffusion of light. In fact, it emanated from everything with the same level of intensity or strength, making me realize more clearly the profundity of a wise and well-known maxim: good light is the life of your eyes. In this case, I'm trying to translate what I saw inside the flying saucer, without alluding to any possible prior influence. Surrounding the entire structure of the room, except on the side of the aforementioned panel, there were a series of small windows interspersed with dividing lines. They were uniform, oval-shaped, about 25 centimeters in size. They were arrayed at a height of 1.80 meters high. They resembled small stained glass windows in rows separated by polished steel frames, like in modern architectural buildings. I tried in vain to find the door that had been opened for me to enter. It had closed with sliding motion, and its recess had disappeared, or at least any gap was imperceptible to me. In that room, a veritable half-sphere, what attracted my attention the most, leaving me perplexed by the unknown reasons for its configuration, was undoubtedly a kind of panel full of stencils, a kind of panel full of grooves, levers and buttons, with a viewing screen in the center. The X point of the spacecraft had to be there. It was there that the control of the motive forces and all the devices of the flying disc must take place. It probably reflected the progress of those entities in matters of navigation or propulsion. It was interesting to see that this panel also kept in line with the rounded configuration of the disc's wall. Not even the cockpit escaped the systematic curvilinearity of the whole. Right in the center, it stood out, concave, white and oval. About 70 centimeters from edge to edge. It had buttons, like tuners, some opaque, others more luminous, varying in their degree of intensity. The levers seemed to run in grooves or channels, and there were other unknown devices, with small symbols underneath, let's say, shorthand. The elaborate controls were composed of the same material, arranged in a uniform way, which offered a certain harmony, instilling respect for its undoubted capacity to easily control the powerful ship. It measured approximately 3 meters long by 1.80 meters in height. I was looking at it from every angle. I couldn't find any wires, connections, hands, indicators, dials, registers identical to those used in our commercial or tourist aeroplanes. What's more, everything seemed to me to be made out of one piece, as if it were a single block of the same material. It was made of a consistent, uniform material, possibly phosphorescent, so malleable that it could be adapted to the most varied purposes. This point was of the utmost importance to me because, having worked for years as a section manager in a company dealing with metallurgy, I was familiar with the physical and chemical processes to which minerals are subjected in order to extract metals. However, I hadn't learnt of anything similar known on Earth to allow me to assess or deduce their constitution. I struggled in vain to conclude anything. In vain, I tried to solve the enigma in order to find the smallest detail that could provide clues to its composition. Abandoning the indecipherable enigma of that unknown control complex, I turned my attention to the creatures that had induced me to join the craft and began to observe them. I was staring at their physical incongruity before, including the disparity in size and strength, when a sinister idea occurred to me. Would they want to use me as a guinea pig? Anguish came over me again, now, was growing unbearably, because I wasn't in my own in my element, but in an entirely new environment. Fortunately, they sensed the distressing condition I was in, a pseudo-victim in their ship and, coming to meet me, tried to reassure me. They tried to reassure me with the following words: "We didn't come to your planet to look for you. We are continuing a mission. In fact, a mission of peace that gravitates around a nucleus called evolution and which fulfills the dictates of divine wisdom. Have no fear, we are brothers and we want to be friends with your people. After this visit, we'll return you to your world and you'll certainly ask us to make other journeys." That term divine wisdom echoed in my ears in such a beneficial way that it brought me back to peace. No expression has ever brought about such a transformation in me. I was calm again and I thought, thank God, they're God-fearing too. In the face of what had happened, I wondered, could it be that they have the power to know my thoughts? Are they that powerful? Now, more serene and to disguise my disappointment, I asked them, why don't we leave? The answer was a discreet smile that revealed the naivety of my question, and one of them added solicitously, we've been traveling for a long time. Without even being able to control myself, I ran to one of the many little windows and looked out. Everything was space, I could see nothing outside. I leaned on my tiptoes to be able to see through the little windows, but all in vain. Everything was empty space. I went round in every direction, but my efforts were in vain. Always a vacuum and I could see nothing. Anxious and visibly distressed, I turned to the person standing next to the screen in the center of the panel. Realizing my torment, he very kindly invited me to come and see your planet, which you won't be able to see with the naked eye. Come and look at this screen. As I approached the panel, they pressed on a small lever like a light switch. Immediately, the Earth globe appeared on the screen, entirely suspended in space, as if it had been televised. A large greenish ball in the center of the screen gradually began to grow larger, giving rise to contours, and in succession, mountains, seas, lakes and rivers. By pressing other buttons, they miraculously transformed the projection, and now in panoramic view a great city appeared. As its details became clearer, I could recognize the city of São Paulo. I saw Congonhas Airport, the Ipiranga Museum, the State Bank Building, the Martinelli Building and the Bank of Brazil, all the main landmarks of São Paulo's the capital city. Enraptured by such perfection, I was trying to see all the other details, when they started to focus only on the perimeter of the central squares, Ciclovis Bevilacqua. At that moment, I could recognize the people passing by with incredible clarity. I could see passers-by, the cars, the buses, the endless queues of people under their respective roofs and could even make out the newspapers stacked up next to the newsagents. It was as if it were possible to stand on a platform at a height of about 5 meters, from whose position he could see both squares, such was the clarity of the projection. The details projected on the screen were so meticulous that you would have thought you were taking part in that intense movement, without hearing, however, the sound of engines or the chatter of passers-by. Chapter 3, Talking Beyond the Ionosphere.